Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business. From liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
You know success when you see it, or you think you do, the people in the spotlight. But what about those small business masterminds who succeed at making their money work harder? They do that by having a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, which now earns 5% annual percentage yield. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
Bloomberg Audio Studios.
Podcasts, radio, news.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. Insight from the reporters and editors who bring you America's most trusted business magazine. Plus, global business, finance, and tech news. The Bloomberg Business Week podcast with Carol Messer and Tim Stenebeck from Bloomberg Radio.
One other name that is on our radar and stock, shares of Alphabet, down about 2.3%. It's been on our mind all this week. You remember on Monday, the stock dropped about 4.5% amid renewed fears about Google's AI offerings. And that after a research note from Melius research analyst Ben Reitzes, who noted that problems with AI tools may fuel the perception that Google is an unreliable source for AI, his words, and create an opening for competitors. Ben Reitzes also specifically highlighting the possibility of users growing concerned about Google's bias. Our Ed Ludlow spoke with Ben Reitzes earlier this week about his note and concerns on Google's AI strategy. Check it out.
You want to make sure they don't have a Bud Light moment, and we're not sure yet. I don't want to weigh in on the merits of what they did or the debate. It's just real simple. When you alienate a part of the population and they believe that you may not be a source of truth, that's not good for business in their business.
That was Ben Reitzes speaking to our own Ed Ludlow earlier this week. Alphabet CEO Sundar Pichai responding to the concerns as the stock is now down nearly 6% so far this week. Sundar Pichai saying in an email to employees, quote, "We have been arguing that search behavior is about to change with new AI-infused futures. This once-in-a-generation change by itself creates opportunities for competitors, but even have a meaningful portion of user growth continued about Google's hallucinations and bias." Excuse me, that was from Reitzes. I should say, Sundar Pichai saying, no AI is perfect, especially as this emerging stage of the industry's development, but we know the bar is high for us, and we'll keep at it for however long it takes.
This has been, and we're just trying to keep track of it, because there's been a back and forth going on all week here. So let's get to it. We knew we had to get to the bottom of the concerns and what is going on at Alphabet and its key Google unit. So with us is the co-host of Bloomberg Technology on BTV, Ed Ludlow. He's in our San Francisco bureau. And also with us is Bloomberg News technology reporter Davey Alba in New York City. Ed, I want to start with you. At the heart of this is Gemini, formerly Bard, Google's flagship AI product. Step back for us. The criticism from the analyst, the chief concerns, you talked with him. And then let's get into Sundar Pichai's response.
Sure. And by the way, not just him. You know, I'm speaking to a lot of people that the investor concern is, right, that Gemini is the poster for Google and its public-facing AI tools and competence. But the deeper concern is that AI technology is going to spread and underpin all of the things we know Google for, search, YouTube, in the long run. And those are the bread and butter businesses. And that's a concern, right? It's an issue of trust. And what I find extraordinary about this story, I applaud you and commend you guys for being so thorough on explaining what happened. But investors do have short memories. If you go back to exactly 1 year ago, what happened? Google released Bard. And in that demonstration video, it was asked about the Hubble telescope. You may remember, I believe I came on the show with you and talked about it. And it gave an incorrect answer. And what played out was downward pressure on the stock. Significant. We're seeing the same thing play out this week. Trust has been damaged, and that's hurting the shares.
And Ed, what do you make of Sundar Pichai's response, the way he tried to handle this yesterday at the company?
Yeah, I mean, it's a pretty direct and frank admission, you know, that verbatim he said that the answers given by the text and image generation side of Gemini insulted and offended people and that it was unacceptable. What I'm interested to hear from Dave is that he said they got teams now working around this on this around the clock.
Right.
Well, how do you fix it?
Well, and let's, so Davey, come on in. Your story with your Bloomberg colleagues digs into internally what's been going on at Google specifically around its ambitious AI strategy. I mean, February was supposed to be a pretty good month from them, but it hasn't played out. Tell us what's been going on behind the scenes.
Yeah, you know, you're right. February was supposed to be a banner month for Google and its AI products. It released a bunch of updates, including some impressive new upgrades to Gemini, an open source model called Gemma, and, you know, more context windows so you can kind of query the AI for longer text and video. But, you know, this controversy has been playing out all week, and our reporting found that the way Google rolled out this technology included a technical fix that would transform the prompt that you would actually send to Google and kind of force some outputs that would try to mitigate the inherent biases of AI, given that it's trained on such a corpus of data that does preference, you know, sort of Western images and stereotypes. And so Google basically overcorrected in releasing Gemini. And now, you know, the company is trying to work hard to fix it. But I, in my opinion, this is going to be a long journey for them. They will have to really take a look at how they built this product from the ground up and try to see what fixes they can make to the fundamental product rather than kind of a Band-Aid fix that they rolled out.
Well, I want to throw it back to Ed just for a second here, sure, to help contextualize where Gemini is slash was when it comes to LLMs that are out there. Like, where does it compare to OpenAI's and other ones that Meta Platforms perhaps are working on and either ones from other companies as well?
Well, look, I think Davey would agree that the way Alphabet and Google, Alphabet, the parent of Google, have rolled out first Bard and now Gemini, the kind of all-encompassing generative AI tool, has been more careful and in different stages than others have rolled out their chatbots. You know, they did it with limited beta access at first, opening it up to a wider audience. I do think it's important, Tim, to remember kind of what happened to set this all off, which is, basically, Gemini was asked what was worse, Hitler or Elon Musk. And that's a very layman's and short answer. But the response that the Gemini bot gave was, it's hard to say. And so that is what spurred the debate online. The problem being that at the root of your question is, we are 12 months on from the general release. And so that's worrying, right? Because if you go back in history, Google is at the advent of the R&D that went into early AI. Fast forward to the first 12 months of commercialization, and it that response on that specific question has got a lot of people saying, well, how on earth could Google, of all companies, allowed it to get to this stage?
Right. And, you know, Davey, considering that Google, you guys write in your story that's on the Bloomberg today, that Google pioneered some of the techniques that are today at the heart of the AI boom. So it's kind of ironic, but come on in on some of what we just heard from Ed in terms of what's been going on and what they're finding out, some of the issues.
Yeah, you know, this is a problem for all large scale AI systems, not just Google. This is something that OpenAI faces and, you know, Meta's LLM faces. The fact is that these AI systems are trained on all of the internet's data, basically. And if you think about what's on the internet, a lot of it is kind of garbage. And so the way that the AI mirrors what it's trained on is a huge problem, and one that these companies don't have an elegant fix for. So Ed's right, Google has been absolutely way more careful than some of its other peers in rolling out its products. It usually does so in experimental stages first. But the problem is that there is no other way to train these AI systems. Right. And so when you have this fundamental issue of the AI kind of being problematic, what they can do is apply sort of hard-coded fixes on it, technical fixes. And in this case, our reporting found, you know, they may have gone a little too far, which is how you get these absurd answers of like, who is worse, Elon Musk or Hitler? Well, and it's like, oh, waffling, like we can't say one way or the other.
So guys, we've got about a minute left, and let me go to you first. So how should we, and I'm thinking about the Bloomberg audience of investors trying to say, well, wait a minute, is this a really big issue? This is just part of a bigger, broader story as we wade our way through this new world of AI? Like, what is it?
Yeah, it's hard for me to answer. I'll go with investors vote with their feet right. And the negative share reaction this week was not as severe as the negative reaction 1 year ago in that example of Bard making a mistake. You just have to continue to see how investors interpret the bigger picture. How does Gemini relate to its core businesses and either improve them or cause more concern?
Davey, saving 25 seconds for you. Your thoughts forward, you know, as you continue to report this out.
Yeah, I'm curious to see what fixes Google will have going forward. The CEO of DeepMind, Demis Hassabis, had just said this week that he intends for this feature to go back online within the next couple weeks. And I think if they don't have anything more than kind of the Band-Aid fix that we saw, then, you know, investors will probably take note and vote accordingly.
Investors are not shy when there's any kind of AI angle that disappoints. Guys, this is exactly what we wanted to do, a deep dive on this, which has been over the news throughout the week. Co-host of Bloomberg Technology, Ed Ludlow, and of course, our thanks to Bloomberg News tech reporter, Davey Alba.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. You need a company with extensive experience in specialized insurance. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and helping provide coverage that suits your needs. The Hartford offers insurance solutions that help mid to large-sized businesses, like yours, effectively manage risk, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. With extensive experience in underwriting, risk engineering services, and claims, The Hartford goes beyond the expected to deliver innovative, customizable solutions and service that your industry, that your business, demands. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Success is more than the final destination. It's a path you take one step at a time. It's discipline, it's teamwork, and it's the drive and passion inside of us that comes before all recognition. It's what Stifel's been doing for over 130 years. Quietly, yet strategically, Stifel's become one of the fastest growing wealth management and investment banking firms in the country. Our financial advisors go beyond traditional wealth management to provide clients with direct access to one of the industry's largest equity research franchises and a leading middle market investment bank. Because success is the drive it takes to keep climbing, the passion to keep investing, the best of each of us made better by the best in all of us. And that is where success meets success. Start your journey at Stifel.com. That's Stifel.com.
Stifel Nicholas and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Catch us live weekday afternoons from 2 to 5 p.m. Eastern. Listen on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. Or watch us live on YouTube.
Well, shares of the power generation company NRG Energy hitting a record high today intraday before dropping back. This following its latest quarterly update, the company reaffirming its 2024 guidance and an upbeat forecast for 2024 adjusted EBITDA. So we continue to get some news and earnings reports, including on some of the energy names.
Yeah, and it's important to follow, of course, because Bloomberg News recently reported how the U.S. power grid is struggling to maintain an even flow of electricity and putting homes at risk. It was a big take a couple of weeks ago. We covered it here. on the program. So with more on some of the trends shaping the electricity sector as an investment play, we're joined by Timothy Kramer, the CEO at CNIC Funds. It's home to the CNIC ICE U.S. Carbon Neutral Power Futures Index ETF, which has about $4 million in assets in the fund. That's according to Bloomberg. Down about 12% since it began trading in May of last year, down about 4% year to date. Tim joins us from Houston. Tim, good to have you on the program today. Talk a little bit about who this is for. Carol and I did some digging in the Bloomberg terminal, and it was a bit tough to make sense of what exactly is in the ETF and what it tracks. So give us the details here.
Sure. So what's in the ETF is electricity futures. So ICE, the Intercontinental Exchange, has the futures listed. So just like you've got crude oil futures, gold futures, et cetera, you've got these futures on electricity. And so what the index and then the ETF has in it is it takes an average of six of the major power trading hubs in the U.S. and it takes those futures and then it weights them according to what the electricity consumption is in the U.S.
So who is this for? I'm curious about. You guys have about a little bit more than $4 million in assets under management. Who do you target with this? What kind of exposure is an investor looking for by tapping into this ETF?
Sure. So electricity is the most consumed commodity in the U.S. on a retail notional basis. But up until now, it hasn't been in any ETF, any index, any mutual fund, nothing. So right now, if you take a look, modern portfolio theory says that you should have somewhere between 5 and 15% of your AUM allocated to commodities, and that's for portfolio diversification and for inflation protection. So if you take a look, pensions and endowments typically have about 3% right now allocation, and there's like over $800 billion tied to the Bloomberg Commodity Index and other commodity indexes. So this is geared towards a few different types of audiences. The first would be, we'll say, model portfolio. So if you take a look, a lot of the major platforms have been pushing a 60-40 portfolio, so 60% equity, 40% debt. And now they're trying to fine tune that a bit. And so they're pushing like a 60-35-5 with the five being commodities. And so if you look back over the past 3, 5, and 7 years on an absolute basis and on a risk adjusted basis, the 60-35-5 has been beating the 60-40. But if you do a 60-35-3-2, three in commodities and two in electricity, it beats everything on an absolute and a risk adjusted basis. So we think a model portfolio for investors would make sense. And then for the pensions and endowments, this gives you inflation protection because CPI is 2.5% electricity month in and month out.
Right.
And this electricity index is 80% correlated to inflation.
I saw Carol furiously writing down every number you just mentioned there, Timothy.
It was a lot.
Hey, so I do have to ask, though, in terms of exposure to commodities, there are a lot of different ways to get exposure to commodities. So somebody watching could be saying, okay, well, you know, I could buy this ETF, or I could buy crude, I could buy natural gas, I could buy coal. These are all things that are used in the U.S. to generate power. Why not just go directly to the source in terms of how that power is generated? I mean, they could buy equity, you know, equity in companies that are solar companies.
So, in terms of going to the actual source, we'll go with the crude and natural gas that you mentioned first. The U.S. has a stated goal of being 85% renewable generation by 2030 and 100% carbon free by 2035. And so you're seeing less and less reliance on fossil fuels and more on other types of generation. And that creates a number of problems. And so you get direct exposure to the electricity as a commodity with this particular product. That's the first thing. And then if you do the equities, well, you know, you don't know if they'd hedge their exposure or not, and they can have accounting irregularities and they got to cover management and overhead. So you're not really getting the clean direct exposure to the commodity itself as if you played the index or this ETF.
Talk to us about flows. Over 4 million in assets under management. What kind of flows have you seen in and out as of late?
So right now, we've got interest from some of the platforms and from family offices. And we have seen some people that have been trading this in terms of their view on natural gas and or absolute price levels on commodities. And I will point out that what happens is we had probably the warmest winter, January and February of 24, that, you know, we've ever had. And so that's kind of depressed the price of this a little bit. And so that was due to an El Nino phenomena. But we are looking now for this summer for La Nina to be a very hot and a very dry summer. So we're seeing interest in this pick back up with people that are looking to try to profit or participate on that.
So Tim, is that it? Like, you, in terms of participation, you're kind of relying on the weather in terms of interest into the ETF. I'm just curious about what's the strategy for getting AUM a little bit higher here.
Sure. So to get the AUM higher, we're having conversations with the exact same pensions and endowments that we talked about. Mm-hmm. And we're also having the conversations with some of the platforms about getting onto the model portfolios and getting this more available to some of the retail investors.
Interested in your thoughts just on infrastructure and on the grid, since you're so involved in this space, Tim. I mean, there's been so much reporting, especially in your home state in Texas after that grid failure a couple of years ago, during that really huge cold snap in the winter. Are U.S. grids up to snuff to handle increasing power consumption as we do shift and start using more and more electricity?
The short answer is no. The easy way to describe that is there was an article that came out the other day that talks about completion rate. And so approximately 8.7% of everything that goes into the development queue gets built. So there's a lot of things that are trying to get built as we're going towards that 100% renewable, but it's very difficult to get them permitted, and it takes a longer period of time to do it. It's up from like between 2 to 3 years, and now it ranges between 4 and 7 years. So the fact that it's difficult to get the stuff permitted and it's taking longer to build, you need to combine that with the fact that you've got higher expenses. And so, you know, higher interest rates, higher labor costs and things like that just make it more prohibitively expensive to get the grid to where it needs to be for the stability factor that you're referencing.
I am curious, when you look at the electricity market, I mean, we talk a lot about AI, right? And machine learning and the amount of power that's going to be needed. We talked about EVs, autonomous vehicles, the amount of power needed just inside the vehicle to make it all happen if it's autonomous. In terms of the fundamentals, the factors, the macro factors, what do you see, Tim, as the biggest factors impacting demand, raising it over the next couple of years?
You nailed it, right? So a couple of sound bites would be: a Google search takes 1 watt of power, an AI search takes 100 watts, and it takes 1,000 watts to train that. So the AI right there tells you kind of what the demand is. You guys talk about Bitcoin. You've got it scrolling across your screens. And so when you look at Bitcoin, 40% of all Bitcoin in the world is mined in the U.S., and 70% of Bitcoin's expense is electricity. And then just the proliferation of data centers, the electricity demand due to data centers alone for data centers should be growing at about 10% a year through like 2030. So just for what you talked about, technology reasons, just a massive amount of demand that we think is understated.
Biggest risk, though, to this strategy for you, and just got about 20 seconds here.
Sure. I mean, the biggest risk is we think from a long-term fundamental play that this looks good. The biggest risk is just short-term if we don't get, demand due to weather.
Yeah.
That can depress prices a little bit. But other than that, from a long-term perspective, we think it's good.
All right. Got to run. Tim, great to get some time. Timothy Kramer, CEO of CNIC Funds.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Listen live each weekday starting at 2 p.m. Eastern on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. You can also listen live on Amazon Alexa from our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
Yes, indeed, folks. He is in from the West Coast, in from the state of California. He's also in charge of investing for the largest teachers retirement system, second largest public pension here in the United States, which provides benefits to California's nearly, did we say, 1 million public school educators and their families. We're talking about the California State Teachers Retirement System, also known as CalSTRS, which, by the way, is also the largest educator-only pension fund in the world. And as of the end of last month, the investment portfolio had more than $325 billion in assets under management. That's a nice little amount to manage.
It's a lot of responsibility, I'd say. Chris Ellman is who we're talking about. He's Chief Investment Officer of CalSTRS. He's back with us here in the Bloomberg Interactive Brokers Studios. So, Chris, it's good to see you. We're going to talk about your future plans in a second, but you shared with us an incredible stat just moments ago that California teachers live longer than any other profession in California.
Any profession in the USA.
Any profession
in the
USA.
We have our own actuary table. Think about it.
That makes your job a lot harder.
They're all college educated. They're typically non-smokers. They live in California, so they have healthier lifestyles, eating habits. And they're 72% women. Women live longer than men. So we have over 400 teachers that are retired over 100 years old.
So you better which get
means,
it right.
Yeah, that means they're dipping into their pension plans for longer than other
Oh, yeah.
People.
Longevity is a big challenge for me.
That's so interesting to hear.
Yeah.
I mean, and what was the stat about the teachers over 100?
400 more. I think right now we're about 450 teachers that are over 100 years old. We write them a happy birthday card at 100. I kind of cringe a little bit because it's like, wow. You know, we got a card back from a teacher that was 100 very legible writing, thrilled about her daughter that was 80, her granddaughter that was 60, and telling us that her great-granddaughter was a teacher and thinking about retiring.
I think I'm going to move to California and become a teacher.
It's too late now. Yeah, you got to start when you're young.
So let's talk about, though, the investment environment, something we always like to do. You guys have to, you know, guarantee that there are going to be the money there for those who tap into this fund and this retirement fund. How do you continue to think about it in today's environment, and what's the smartest strategy?
How much
does it shift, Chris, based on, you know, we're day to day, the gyrations, over it. You've got to think longer term, bigger, broader to make sure you have those returns.
I'm here at Bloomberg because of the focused capital on the long term, a conference that we're part of and a group that we're really trying to help. The key is to think long term. So I've got a 30-year horizon. I think long term. I always say we're a giant cruise ship out on the ocean. We're not going to ever go to port. We're always out in rough weather or smooth weather. And what we're doing is making subtle course corrections. So I'm listening to you guys every day on my car to work, back home. I'm a diehard listener to Bloomberg Radio.
Thank you.
And I am paying attention to the nuances in the market, but I am not making giant corrections to that portfolio. It's long term. You've got to have a thought that it's a marathon, and every year is just one pace in a marathon, 1 year mile in a marathon.
So when you listen to either conversations from the investing space, or when you listen to Bloomberg, what is it that makes you sit up a little straighter and say, "Oh, that's an interesting trend," or "That's something significant that could be a longer term investment play"?
Carol, the old adage of "Don't fight the Fed." I'm listening to what the Fed's saying today. What Jim Williams, who's from Sacramento, is saying. You know, at the New York Fed. Listening to them first and foremost and paying attention to their directions, but then the other overall trends within the U.S. market and the global markets, because it's not just the U.S. central bank we have to pay attention to.
But global central bankers, then.
Oh, yeah. No, because we are a truly global portfolio. We have a home country bias to the USA. It's over half of the market, and it's about 75% of our portfolio. But it still is interest rates first, and you're really listening to whether people are greedy or fearful. And the old Warren Buffett adage is still true. If people are fearful, then that's time to be greedy. If they're greedy, like now, it's time to be a little fearful.
So when can you get greedy again? When are people going to be fearful?
That's always the tough question. You know, it's the consumer right now is really in a bad mood. But what surprises me, they're flying on planes. All the airports are jammed. They're going to restaurants. They're, you know, the lower end consumer is struggling. But we hit a soft landing. We're doing okay, and the market's at repeating record highs.
You've said we've landed the plane.
Yep.
Look at that. We hit a soft landing.
Well, it's kind of interesting. So you think
we got a call here?
Okay. Okay.
I said it to you, Carol, back in December. We hit the soft landing. It's done.
Done.
Inflation is not totally under control. It's going to jump up to 3s and 4s, and then back to 2s. We're going to be in a higher inflation environment, but that doesn't mean the Fed is going to ease. I think
does the Fed even need to cut rates?
I think for the market's sake, they need to come off, but maybe not more than 3 cuts in this year at most. They do not need to ease back. Real interest rates are probably around 3%. That's what the Fed has said before.
But if we're at a soft landing, you're saying to maintain that soft landing, they're going to have
to Yeah, the economy, you know. We hear every week about some companies with job cuts. Employment, though, in other sectors is strong. A lot of enthusiasm, obviously, about the productivity gains we'll see in AI. Those things have to play out over time. And the Fed shouldn't rush because inflation is sticky and it's going to be difficult to maintain.
Hey, I want to talk a little bit about how you buy and what you buy. Because you have a real passive bias in addition to a U.S. bias. So you said 75% of the portfolio is U.S. focused.
Yeah.
How much of that is equities? And of those equities, what are you buying?
The key to us is we're about 48% global equity. Over half of that's in the USA. We are passive. In other words, we own the Russell 3000 index from Microsoft all the way down to the bottom stock.
Right.
And we're going to hold that. So we own the Magnificent Seven. Those are amongst our top largest holdings. But we still have fixed income. We have real estate. We have private equity. We're broadly diversified. We have infrastructure. We have some inflation-sensitive assets. So it's a very diversified portfolio, but a blend of public and private holdings.
What's been your biggest change? Since you kind of tend to, right, set a strategy and let it stick. You're not kind of moving in and out every day. That's not what you guys do. Is there anything, though, in the last 6 to 12 months that's been something new or a new, kind of just playing around with it a little bit?
You guys have talked about private credit and the concern about private credit, the money going in. If anything, we're still invested, but we've slowed down. The advantage to private credit is when rates are rising, being a variable rate, it's going to climb with it. Well, now rates have peaked and now they're going to start easing off. So there's no reason to rush in. It's a nice alternative to general fixed income. And trading bonds in this market has been tough.
But tempering back a little bit.
Just pacing ourselves, I think, a bit more discretionary and paying attention. Anytime you have like this kind of an environment where you're going to have some stress coming up in the year in terms of people that can't pay, then you want to have to do your credit analysis and pay attention to your exposures.
So, Chris, we got to talk about your plans, because you said last month that you were stepping down after 24 years at CalSTRS. Why now? What's next?
Hey, age. I've been there long enough. Time to retire, slow down, do some bike riding, and then just do a few other things. I have a real passion about climate change and talking to U.S. and non-U.S. investors about that.
Good to hear.
I think that the energy transition we have to go through, CalSTRS, we say 15 years. I'm telling people it's 7 years. 2030 sounds like a long time from
What's
now.
What's the transition?
That we really have to move away from hydrocarbons is our source of electricity, propulsion, manufacturing, agriculture, and we have to find other alternative sources. We need more energy around the whole world, and we need different energy.
I don't disagree. It's become, though, a political firestorm in terms of, I don't know. Do you think that's going to continue to kind of slow that process down, that shift away from fossil fuels?
Oh, this is a hard change. Think back to when we moved from BlackBerries to iPhones. Everybody jumped on them. Number one, they were a huge investment, and they were free because the telephone company embedded the cost to you. Everybody moved instantly. This transition is not going to be free. It's not necessarily more efficient. It's a change, and it's probably going to be a little bit expensive. So, Carol, therefore, you're going to see fits and starts. You're going to see people who've devoted their life and the industry to traditional methods, hanging on to those. We still have coal plants around the world, for goodness sake.
Yep.
But Mother Nature is going to teach us all a very harsh lesson.
Anybody?
Right on the TV screens, you know there are big brush fires in the middle of winter in Texas. And then they're going to have snow. And, you know, LA had a hurricane, an earthquake, and then a fire. You know, you're going to have these extremes.
We look forward to the work you do on that. Come back when you want to talk more about that. Chris Allman, we've always appreciated the conversations with you. Chief Investment Officer of CalSTRS, joining us in studio. Chris, thank you.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. You need a company with extensive experience in specialized insurance. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and helping provide coverage that suits your needs. The Hartford offers insurance solutions that help mid to large-sized businesses, like yours, effectively manage risk, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. With extensive experience in underwriting, risk engineering services, and claims, The Hartford goes beyond the expected to deliver innovative, customizable solutions and service that your industry, that your business, demands. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Hi, I'm Ron Kraszewski, Chairman and CEO of Stifel. Financial advisors, if you're not growing your practice, you're losing market share. Stifel is a growing, entrepreneurial, advisor-centric firm built for successful advisors like you. Imagine having the resources of the largest wirehouses and the support of the boutique shops, but none of the bureaucracy to get in the way of you serving your clients. At Stifel, it's your business, your book, your clients. I always tell the advisors we're recruiting, I want you to come to Stifel and double or triple your business. Most of them laugh and shake their heads, but I'm serious. Don't take it from me. Take it from Stifel's number one finish in J.D. Power's 2023 U.S. Financial Advisor Satisfaction Study. So there's a reason why 148 financial advisors joined Stifel last year. Come join us and find out why Stifel is the firm where success meets success. Visit www.choosestifel.com.
Stifel Nicolaus and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
I'm driving in my car, I turn on the radio.
How about you let me drive?
Oh, no.
Who's gonna drive you home?
Honey, please, I'll do the driving.
Drive on.
Excuse me, I wanna drive.
He drives me crazy.
It's the question that drives us.
This is the Drive to the Close.
That funky music will drive us till the dawn.
On Bloomberg Radio.
All right, everybody. Well, our next guest says it's time to party like it's 1999. That's because he says there is, quote, no doubt that 2024 is shaping up to be the best year since 1999. So that'll take you a few decades back.
I went back a few decades using Bloomberg data, and I found the NASDAQ 100 that year was up a cool 102%. But Carol, we all know what happened after that.
Yeah, exactly. The tech sell-off and the dot-com boom.
The bubble burst.
All right, so let's get to it. Let's drive to the close with Louis Navalier. He's chairman, founder, and CIO of the company that bears his name. He joins us from Florida. Louis, it's been a while. Nice to have you here. I say this to folks with utmost respect because you've seen a few investment cycles. So how do you describe the cycle that we're in? Is there more? We were just talking with Chris Allman talking about fear versus greed. He thinks there's a lot of greed in this market. How do you see it?
Well, there's a lot of greed because the AI stocks are 10% of global market capitalization. But the two leading hardware AI stocks have over 200% sales growth. So that's justified, in my opinion. I mean, the software has ways to catch up and to be monetized. But NVIDIA supermicrocomputer are worth their capitalizations, and they do not trade at very high multiples when you look out to fiscal 2025. I mean, Supermicro's under 18 times forecasted earnings. NVIDIA's a little higher, but it's a monopoly.
These are all names that you would own and buy. I'm kind of obsessed with Supermicro too. I mean, the stock's up 189% this year. It's not kind of a name that we talk about a lot, but we are talking a lot about it because of its significance, its gains, its moves, and its fundamentals. But these are names you've owned for a long time, or just been piling money into it as of late?
Those are our two largest holdings. NVIDIA I've had for over 5 years. It's my second time back in NVIDIA. I dig it out temporarily. Supermicro we've had for over 2 years. And our biggest holdings after that would be Novo Nordisk, Eli Lilly, the weight loss drugs. Those are capturing a lot of market share. I will admit that even though we're seeing a lot of breath in small caps since an early January effect late last year, that it's still narrow. My opinion is only three of the seven of the Magnificent Seven had really spectacular results, and money is now moving. And Supermicro is a beneficiary of that, and so is Novo Nordisk and Lilly.
Talk to us a little bit about areas that you've missed in recent years, because you're in a pretty good position having owned NVIDIA, Supermicro, Novo Nordisk, and Eli Lilly. What were some missteps in recent years, if you could go back in time?
Meta. I miss Meta because it's a high beta stock, and it went higher on short covering. And the way my system works is we look for high alpha, low deviation. So anytime we get a high beta stock, it doesn't quite fit our model. So there will be some extraordinary stocks running that we will miss. I'll be honest with you, Google's hard to figure out because the guidance is poor. Amazon's a little easier to figure out lately. It's mostly cloud computing, but the retail side is finally going to make some money, we think. And Meta is the big one we missed.
Do you like it now?
It ranks high on our quant criteria, but on my fundamental criteria, I'm not too crazy about it. The techs are funny. You know, the more people they lay off, the more the stocks rally. And you already have Google laying off people because
of
AI.
It is the year or years of, what is it?
Efficiency.
Efficiency.
Yeah, so you got Apple with the Apple Card today. Of course, you broke that news yesterday. You've got Amazon becoming more efficient. A lot of their delivery, they're trying to sub out now because it's not cost effective to have a tube of toothpaste delivered to your house. So they're figuring that one out. But Meta is laying off people. So Maybe it is the AI revolution. Maybe they will just be a company and with some robots. You know, we'll find out. But you know, we're not near that bubble that we had in March of 2000. That was pretty bad back then. I don't have a multiple problem. You know, my average multiple in large cap is barely 18 times this year's estimated earnings, and I got a lot of earnings growth. Small cap, it's well under 10 times this year's estimated earnings, with even more earnings growth. So I don't really have a multiple problem or valuation problem at this time. Obviously, we would like the Fed to start cutting rates.
Is that why you think it's time to party like it's 1999? Because you don't have a problem, whether it's large caps or small caps, Louis, with the valuations that are out there and the multiples?
I think the main reason is we have very easy year-over-year comparisons on the next two quarters. And we just had easy year-over-year comparisons in the fourth quarter. And you saw, you know, 76% of the stocks in S&P beat. The average surprise was 7%, I believe. Of course, NVIDIA was a grand finale. And so we got two more quarters of good earnings. We got the Fed joining the party. And let's face it, in a presidential election cycle, we tend to rally going into the election because we will be promised everything and anything. You know, there's now student loan relief. I thought the court ruled you couldn't do that, but they're going to do it anyway. So, you know, they're going to tell us what we want to hear, and that helps both investor and consumer confidence. And the U.S. is so much better shape than the rest of the world. Mm. We're food and energy independent, we got a strong currency, and we're an oasis for foreign capital. The only thing that could go wrong is, I guess, if our deficit gets too big. I mean, the leading candidates are both going to make the deficit big, so that's going to be interesting to watch.
So, Louis, where would you put new money to work right now, given that arguably people would say, okay, parts of the market are high, though you argue that, you know, the tech names that you're in are not high?
Well, that's an outstanding question. Well, earnings season is over. So I go in every earnings season locked and loaded, and I want to buy stocks on dips now because I don't have really news to drive my stocks to mid-April. But I am buying stocks where analysts are upgrading and raising their estimates. And if the analysts start to cut, I'll get out of their way because I can't fight with the analyst community. But what happens after earnings season, we have a lot of mean reversion going on. And Citadel is pretty good at their mean reversion trading. So my view of the world is we have 4 months where the markets are efficient when earnings are coming out. That's earnings season. And the other 8 months, we have mean reversion. So I just want to sell into strength and buy in dips. I am bullish on energy going into September. We should get a seasonal surge just from the fact there's more people in the Northern Hemisphere than the Southern Hemisphere. But if there's any hint that Trump might become president, I probably will exit most of my energy stocks by September because, you know, he'll drill, and prices could fall.
Interesting. Broad macro, does it matter that much to you who is in the White House? Just got about 30 seconds left here. You mentioned energy specifically for Trump, but more broadly, it doesn't matter to you.
No, because what makes America great is our states compete with each other. Period. And as long as we have the states trying to steal business from each other, business will be good and America will prosper. And we have so much better demographics as well.
All right. Really great to get some time with you. Louis, thank you so much. Louis Navalier, he's chairman, founder, and CIO of Navalier & Associates, joining us from Florida on this Wednesday.
This is the Bloomberg Business Week podcast, available on Apple, Spotify, and anywhere else you get your podcasts. Listen live weekday afternoons from 2 to 5 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg.com, the iHeartRadio app, TuneIn, and the Bloomberg Business app. You can also watch us live every weekday on YouTube and always on the Bloomberg Terminal.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business. From liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Collaborate for a greener future at the Bloomberg Green Festival, a groundbreaking celebration of the thinkers, doers, and innovators leading the way, from design and culture to technology, science, and entertainment. Hear from inspirational speakers and immerse yourself in climate solutions, July 10th through 13th in Seattle.
Title sponsor, Amazon. Official airline, Alaska Airlines. Get 20% off using promo code RADIO20 at BloombergLive.com/greenfestival.